Meeting at the regional high school. Let's move on then to Spain.
All right. Do I start out with my name again?
No, just you, it's going to be on the same tape, so.
Oh, it is. All right. I was married in 1935 to a city banker, a young man, who had always been in the head office down on Wall Street. And just after we were married, we were told that we were going to be moved to Spain, and this would be his first chance at a job abroad in the European district. He had been in the European district for 3 or 4 years. So we went over in October. And
That's October 30?
October 35.
35.
And spent 2 weeks in Paris getting used to Europe, and then went on down, and he was in Barcelona as a sort of an apprentice to the affiliate of the Citibank in Barcelona. And we really knew nothing about Spain except various cultural books that we had read about how beautiful Spain was and what the music was like and the textiles and other things like that. But we're completely blank on what had been happening in the last 5 or 6 years in Spain about strikes that just closed up everything and had to be broken up by the military, and the movement for autonomy by the province of Catalonia, or what Catalan meant in the history of Europe, we knew nothing. So we got there in October of 1935 and stayed at a very nice boarding house run by, of course, a Spanish family. And it was a boarding house where quite a few English and French people were living who were also working in the Barcelona area. We were very impressed by all the manufacturing in Catalonia and took little trips on the train weekends out to various parts. And since then I've found out that it was during World War I that the province of Catalonia really became the munitions supplier for various countries of Europe. And Spain remained neutral and produced ammunition and artillery for the arsenal that was needed by the other countries, France and England, and also for Germany and for Italy.
In other words, both sides.
Both sides were buying from Spain, and both sides remained very interested in Spain. When we got there, we began to sense that there was quite a lot of unrest and that there was conflict between the clericals and the new republic, which had just come in. And
you're speaking about October 35.
Yes.
The new republic, you say that?
Yes, I believe the republic came in just a year before. And it was liberal, progressive, rather socialistic.
Now, they came in February 36, did they not?
Well,
they came in while you were there.
Did.
Right.
Another part of, no, before we got there.
Now, let's go back a little. In 31, the king left.
Yes,
and
in
that
31,
was the establishment
the
of that republic.
Yes.
But in 34, when the Asturian miners were put down.
Yes.
Isn't that when Primo de Rivera, I'm not sure about
yes,
this, I'm
Primo
just asking.
Primo de Rivera staged a coup.
Right. Was that in 34?
I believe it was in 34.
So at 35 there was a change before 36?
In 35 the Republic was still there. There was a Republic.
Uh-huh.
And not a dictatorship. This Republican movement kept coming back as there'd be various coups.
Okay. All right.
And we weren't terribly interested in that because we were getting used to the American consulate and what it did. We had many friends in the consulate general there. And the emphasis was really on international business rather than anything else, so far as we could see. But strange things began to happen. And we took little trips up through Catalonia. And one of the towns was Vic, and another one was Olot. And in the town squares, there was the hammer and sickle, a big red flag, and pictures of Marx, pictures of Lenin, huge posters. So we realized that there was an undercurrent of something else than the Republic.
And none of this was seen in Barcelona. You didn't see it in Barcelona.
We weren't conscious of it.
You weren't conscious.
We weren't conscious
right.
of it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We could walk anywhere in Barcelona. In fact, the whole place was wide open, 24 hours a day, and you felt perfectly safe, no matter what part of the city you were in.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you went slumming to some of the theaters way down on the port and so
right.
on. You felt perfectly safe, and people were polite to you and so on, and there wasn't the mugging in the streets that is said to go on now. But about Easter time, there began to be really great unrest. This would be 36. And we went down to Madrid for Easter of that year. And there were some churches in Madrid that had been set on fire by gangs. And two of the names that they talked about were the Sindicalistas
mm-hmm.
and then the Front Popular. And they were made up of socialists and syndicalists and also the very famous anarchists. But the Spanish anarchists philosophically, as they wrote about what they believed, they felt that each person was really responsible. And if you didn't have laws, people would behave the way they ought to. And so why hold people down? Because that's what makes them want to rebel. So this was the anarchist idea. Get rid of all government and then we'll have the kingdom of heaven. But some of the other allied parties felt differently, and they wanted to have the revolution or evolution come more quickly through a legal government. Then later than Easter, when we got back, there began to be incidents that were very unpleasant downtown. And I can remember my husband coming home late from work for dinner one night. And he looked scared to death. And he said he'd been on a streetcar, and quite a few of the people on the streetcar had stood up and shaken their fists at him and said, "Americans, get out. Foreigners, leave." And it was a very upsetting experience for him.
Now this was in April approximately,
yes,
in that
April and May.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We had really an international group of friends, and two of the friends were Germans. And the young German man would fly in, it wasn't a hang glider, but it was a glider without any power. And he and the club that he belonged to, most of them Germans, would go up to the top of Tibidabo, the high mountain to the north of Barcelona. And then they would ride their gliders down to the plain behind. And then their wives would come and pick them up later in the day. And I can remember our maid of all work, who was a Basque girl, said that, oh, those Germans, you can't trust them at all. Why do you have them for friends? All they're doing is spying on the Spaniards to find out where our munitions are. And then that was the first I'd heard of Spain having a lot of munitions. And her bow wasn't from the Basque country, but from another Western province. And he was in sort of a home guard that did training, but it didn't have any real standing at all. It was just a group of young men who were marching and probably pointing sticks at things instead of having any guns. Well, this went on with the unrest increasing until July 16th, when all of a sudden, at about 5 o'clock in the morning, all the church bells rang, and of course woke everybody up. And the maid, who was a little bit maid, said, "The war has started."
July 16th.
Yes, and indeed it had, and made a lot of changes. Now the thing, of course, that I was conscious of all the time, and that my husband was conscious of, was the rumor that was going around, and feeling that business was stable. You could still keep on doing international business out of Madrid and out of Barcelona, and that everybody was safe because the British had a large fleet stationed in the Mediterranean keeping the peace. And as the war went on, we could see the sides vying with each other, fleet, the head ship, the London, came into port in Barcelona. And the crew had been on that ship for so long and hadn't been able to land and get on land. And they were just really wild, and they had two movies that they'd been seeing for about 3 years. And so a lot of the men, the businessmen, said, "Well, here's Pathé with the big store of movies, and we'll get new movies to you for every night." And then they realized that there was a laundry business, a laundry problem. All the officers having to wear white uniforms and so on, and just terribly hard for them to do their own laundry. So all the laundresses who worked for the foreign colony were pressed into service to do the uniforms for the lads on the HMS London. As the war went on, and it had been pretty bad for a few days around Barcelona, with shooting in the streets, time off only for about an hour and a half at noon for siesta and shopping, and you could go out then and shop.
They stopped shooting.
They stopped shooting. It was perfectly safe. You could go out and go to market.
Right.
Come back. But we couldn't use our balcony during that time, because if you went out on the balcony to have a sun bath, pretty soon there'd be a little whistle that sounded like a swallow, and then a ping against the outside stone, and you realize that somebody thought you might be shooting at them, so they were just going to warn you, don't do anything funny. So we couldn't really sit out on the balcony. And finally, when the fighting stopped in Barcelona, and there must have been a lot of it, we and another city banker walked downtown to the bank, about 3 miles, and the stench was unbelievable. Dead horses, in the streets that hadn't been cleaned up yet. And everybody, all our friends said, don't buy meat because you'll be getting caballo. And the food situation was getting to be a little bit desperate for people coming in. Less frequently with produce from the country. And so the council in charge decided that he'd better get rid of all of the American women and start an exodus that way. So he shipped out a lot of people, and Ben, because he was really on a training appointment at the bank, was not allowed to work at the bank anymore, so he volunteered at the Consulate General, and so I did too, and did typing and things like that that were needed. And then finally, the council in charge decided that I'd better go. The other people were saying, well, if she's still here, why do I have to leave? So I left in August, early August.
36.
Of 36. Mm-hmm. It's probably, it might have been the 10th of August. And I spent the first night down in the harbor, the Puerto Marítimo, on the HMS London. And one of the officers very nicely gave up his quarters for me. So I had a very nice berth. And then at 5 o'clock the next morning, I boarded the destroyer Gypsy and went out to Marseille, where a lot of our friends had already gone, and they had a delightful little seaport hotel where they were living, and the wife of the consul in charge and her children were there. So I felt very much at home with them. And then I began getting letters almost on a daily basis coming out by destroyer from my husband. And he had been sent down to La Esquina and to Madrid. And it was a very scary ride because La Esquina, which is the corner where there were two railroad lines, one down the coast and then one from the coast into Madrid. And that was a place where there was often fighting between the two sides. The so-called insurgents who were under General Franco, and then the ones who were under generals from the Republic. But he got through and took whatever it was he had to take to Madrid and then got back safely. He also was given a mission to rescue somebody that the consulate had working for them at one of the towns in the interior called Igualada. And he was given a car draped with an American flag, and beside him in the front seat was a soldier with a loaded rifle pointed out this way, and behind him on the back seat were two others with their rifles pointed out that way, cocked, all ready to go. And they drove down to Igualada and arrived just about lunchtime at the office that where the Spanish employee of the Consulate General was going to be picked up. And that office, because it had an American flag on it, became sort of a safety center or sanctuary for a lot of people in Igualada. And there were two priests there who felt it wasn't safe to be in their own parishes. And food was sent in for all three meals, and they just had this beatific expression on their faces, Ben said. Eating chicken and just stuffing it in as if it were their last meal. And almost in tears when the Americans left. And so they drove back with the employee and got back safely. But just that kind of a superficial feeling about the war would be an incident here and an incident there and so on. But it happened the day that I got to Marseille. I went right away to the Consulate General in Marseille to register. that I was there. And I went by streetcar from the port in Marseille up to the Place Saint-Ferréol. And when I got to the consulate general there, one of the young men said, "You didn't have any trouble on the streetcar?" And I said, "No, why?" And he said, "Well, another streetcar at about the same time had been turned over by a group of iron workers who are socialists, and they want the government of France to change more quickly and give them more benefits than they have already been given."
Yeah, they also had a popular front government.
And they had a popular front.
Blund.
Yes.
Yes.
That's right.
Right. Who was Ambassador Bowers there when you were there?
He must have been in Paris at the time, yes.
Oh, not in Spain.
Not in Spain.
Because he wrote a book, and he was our ambassador to Spain.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure that he ever stayed in Spain. I think he was across the border in a town, something L-U-Z, ends in L-U-Z, and did his
ambassador. San Juan de Luz.
What is it?
San Juan de Luz.
San Juan de Luz.
San Juan de Luz.
Yes. And I think that the ambassador during the war, at least, was there. But he wrote a book on Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Hotchkiss has a book. I don't know about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, when were you in Spain? You were a volunteer.
I got there. I was a volunteer with the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And I got there in at the end of February in 1937.
Mm-hmm.
I came on the Ile-de-France.
Mm-hmm.
That is, came to Spain on the Ile-de-France, and then we were the first group that walked over the mountains, the first American group,
mm-hmm.
as we were with others. There were Americans there before we came who were able to travel mm-hmm. into Spain by train. Our passports had been marked not valid for travel in Spain,
mm-hmm.
and also the French wouldn't permit people to go into Spain, and when we walked over
the mountains, they tried to keep a neutrality,
and they had a
neutral patrol of the ports.
Yes, and the French, as a matter of fact, they would throw searchlights on the paths over the mountains, and we'd have to duck every time a searchlight. When anyhow, we walked over. But it was the end of February in 37.
Did you come over through Andorra or along the coast?
It had to be along the coast because when we got into Spain, we took a very short bus. We were met by buses, and we took a very short bus trip to Figueres,
mm-hmm.
so it had to be along the coast,
yes.
Someplace there. And my first, then what happened was that we stayed in Figueres, and they asked for, they came to the Americans and the English and the Canadians and asked for anybody who'd driven a truck. I had driven a Big Six International between Rock Island, Illinois, and Chicago, and my father was in wholesale fruit and vegetable business, so I easily I was invaluable. And so a group of us we were taken to the border with France. We had to wait for a change of guard, obviously change of the guard who were sympathetic to the Republic, mm-hmm. and we then crossed into France, and there were some English-made Ford trucks with the steering wheel on the right and so on. And so we took those trucks into Spain. And eventually we drove those trucks down through Valencia and across into Madrid.
Well, now was Valencia the capital at that time?
No. No, the
Madrid
capital was still
was.
Madrid.
Mm-hmm.
It was much later when they
Valencia.
And the first action that I participated in, at that time still in transport, was at Guadalajara, just after Guadalajara, at Brueghe.
Yes.
It was right after Guadalajara where the Republican Italians,
yes.
the Garibaldis, who were the anti-fascists, which I met some of them later, I'll tell you about that in a minute, it was very interesting, they fought the Italian troops of Mussolini.
Yes.
And in this case, the Republic, where the Garibaldis gave them a terrible beating and took a lot of prisoners, mm-hmm. officers, and so on, which we transported to Madrid. Later on, I met some of the young Italians in prison. I was captured 17 months later, and mm-hmm. I was in prison just outside of Burgos in a place called San Pedro de Cardenas, mm-hmm. where the El Cid had
been.
And I met some of the Italians. They had been students who had represented Spain in some events, sports events, in France. But instead of going back to Italy, they crossed the mountains and came back to fight with everyone. But anyhow, that was my first thing. Then subsequently, I was at the tail end of Jarama, and then Brunetti and Welchita and so on. I had been transferred to infantry. Then I became a scout, and I was captured in April 11th of 1938, just outside of and just near Batea, which is right near Gandesa. Gandesa is a big site if you know that area. So I spent altogether close to 3 years, 34 months in the area, half in prison and half with the Republic. We didn't see a great deal of what went on. I've learned more about Spain since I've come back, because mm-hmm. like you, when I went to Spain, I didn't speak any Spanish. Mm-hmm. And I guess all I'd ever seen of Spain were a couple of travel posters with flamenco dancers or something. But it was the idea, which very, very strongly felt was similar to the ideas that were involved in our own American Revolution here. Mm-hmm. And of course, I guess in all those events, it always proves that you go to extremes. And in both sides, that was, at this point, looking back at it. But I think that it still is true that at that time there was the feeling of here's what's right and here's what's wrong.
Yes, and I think that persisted in the United States thinking for a long time too.
It still does. I speak I spoke at Trinity and at Loomis Chaffee and Hyde Park and so on this past year, and not many schools on a high school level a deal with Spain. It generally is just a footnote in a textbook or something. But there are some, Hyde Park, Loomis Chaffee, and others that I've spoken to not as often.
Andover Wood.
Yes, yeah. And then some of the, of course, the colleges, Trinity, Dartmouth, many, yes. many colleges. And there's a clear, I think even a clearer representation of what the essential fight about, no matter what the distortions were, mm-hmm. but I think the essence of it.
It was generally a movement toward a more representative form of government, and then coming up the conservatives who wanted it the way it always had been, and so many different varieties of conservatives.
That's the point.
And each one of
them is sometimes missed.
Yes.
You see, there were conservatives in the Popular Front. There were the Republicans who mm-hmm. were part of the Popular Front. The anarchists, interestingly enough, whom you spoke about at the beginning, and you're quite right about what their philosophy is, they would not participate in the Popular Front at the beginning.
That's right.
And then they did join, then they dropped out again subsequently. Is what happened. So there are many internal problems.
And so many parties.
Yeah.
I can remember.
Oh yes.
When Ben came out, because he wasn't a part of the bank, and was transferred to London, where we stayed during the build-up of World War II. One of the the men from head office would come and see the Spaniards who were there. One was a lawyer for the bank, and one was in another capacity, had been a sub-manager in one of the offices. And he'd say, "Get back in. You know what side you're on." And they said, "No. Our family were always of the Carlists. We have nothing to do with them." Or, "Our family was always of some other group. We have nothing to do with what's going on now."
Yeah, the Carlists had they wanted their king.
Yes, they wanted their king.
Don Carlos. They didn't want Don Juan.
That's right.
So and, they had their
And it was
agenda.
Awfully hard for our boss in the European district to understand that it wasn't just this or that, and you just pick on the one you wanted.
When did you come back to the States, though?
Oh, after we'd been in London for a while.
Oh, and then you went to London from France.
Then got his furlough, and then we came home in 38 on furlough.
Oh, in 38?
Yes. Right. But I was thinking of some of the other things about Spain.
Right.
The apartment building where we lived belonged to the Larios family, and they were absentee landlords, but maybe spent part of each spring in Spain when the weather would be the most delightful. And there'd be a general flow back in of the aristocracy. And they had a huge, beautiful house on the corner of Mariano Cubi, our little street, and then they had built this apartment building. And the portera, the wife of the doorkeeper, told us, as things were heading up toward real fighting in the streets, "Don't worry about the Larios. There's a tunnel from their house, and they have their own apartment, and it doesn't even show from the outside. There are no windows or anything, and they can come in and be perfectly safe. Nobody knows it exists." And after the street fighting had stopped, after the 5 days of it, I happened to be looking out our dining room window and saw the most elegant young man, he was probably in his late 40s or early 50s, in a tweed summer suit, lightweight summer suit, and sort of a slouch hat, trying to look very casual, and he had a walking stick, and the head butler came out in his white apron and stood with him. And then they shook hands and said goodbye, and he walked down toward the port, probably thinking he was completely disguised, and he did get on a boat and go out to France. But to see just that little smidge of the terror that there must have been.
Oh, yes, there certainly was.
And we lived on the fifth floor of this apartment building, and there was an ascensor, which meant that you could ride up in it, but you didn't ride down in it. But the young man, the boy, who delivered coal for our stove, wasn't allowed to use the elevator, and he would have a hundred weight of chunks of coal on his back and walk up the five flights and come to the door and then put it in the coal box in the kitchen. And it would take him about 5 minutes before he could stand up straight again. And when the war broke out, he said, "I won't be delivering coal anymore. My father is going to fight for the Republic, and I'm going to go along with him and help him." Mm-hmm. When the boy was, I think, 15 years old.
When I went back to Spain, and one of the trips I took back to Spain, and I think it was 1960 or 61, and I saw 11 and 10-year-old kids doing exactly that kind of work in Sevilla. This was in Sevilla at that time. That was one of the, from the point of view of Spaniards, as I've learned since, I've read a great deal since, I know more now than I did that way. And that was, of course, a basic problem, was a tremendous poverty.
Yes.
When we got to Madrid, when I was told you we drove these trucks from Figueres to Valencia, we were housed on the estate of the Duke of Alba, and we used one of his castle. The castle that he had there is where which was quite luxurious. But I became friends with a Spanish professor who was in one of the transport factories there. And he traced the land that the Duke of Alba owned for one of the lectures he gave us. And he started way up in the north, went all the way to Extremadura in the south of Algeciras, not once leaving the property of the Duke of Alba.
Yeah.
You see? So that was the concentration of wealth.
Yes.
Was so great in the hands of so few.
Yes.
And then the army, of course, was you had one general for every 12 people.
Just about.
So these were some of the problems.
Wasn't like our colonels with 800 men they had to raise themselves.
That's right. And now that was quite different, of course, than what happened in 1931 when Juan left, just got in his car and drove away.
Mm-hmm. They had a museum that had been a castle where he would come up in Barcelona. In the Barcelona area, was called the Pedralbes. And when you went there as a tourist, they showed you the dining room, and here were plates with peas and a piece of a chop and an old roll and so on. And they said, this is where he left. And he left his plate like this. Mm. All the other people left their plates like this.
Well, and left it that way.
And, probably peeled all the way to France. But I think two or three places have that same kind of a setup, saying that this is where he left from.
Because I know that in Seville they have something like that. Did you get to the Montserrat?
Yes.
Oh yeah, isn't that a
We had a wonderful day at Montserrat.
Fabulous.
Went down on the train.
Yeah.
And one of the fascinating things was seeing the little villages where there were pigskins full of new wine that were aging so that you could drink it. It certainly brought to life what was in one of the Gospels about you wouldn't put new wine in old skins.
That's right. I had a wonderful experience there, apart from why I had so many wonderful experiences in Montserrat. We were there in 1978,
mm-hmm.
When we were there again. I've been back a few times. And amongst other things at Montserrat, I became friendly with one of the fathers there who took me up to the top floor of the Montserrat. They have the most exhaustive library on the Civil War than any other place in the world. A wonderful place. There's more written about the Spanish Civil War, second to our Civil War.
Hmm.
Perhaps second to our Civil War. Even in English, I'm trying to remember, I did have that figure, but I think even in English, I really can't recall the figure, so I hate to put it exactly, but thousands and thousands of books have been written. Mm. And the amazing thing is that they continue to be written. There were four new books just recently.
Mm-hmm. Well, talking with you here, I keep remembering little fragments of things that I saw. When things quieted down in Barcelona, I was looking out across the balcony, and I saw two men walking, and I thought, they walk as if they were wearing skirts, and yet they're wearing trousers, and I realized that they must have been priests, clerics,
yes.
And they had just put on ordinary clothes, but they still used their legs as if they were getting a skirt out of the way and not tripping over it.
You're quite observant. And I must say that your recollection, when we were talking about the other things too, here is excellent. Yes, excellent.
Well, like a lot of other people, I have very strong visual recollections.
Good.
But I didn't pull enough of them together to make a good continuity on this. After you started me on the town of Salisbury, I sort of lost the continuity on Spain. One of the things, one of the rumors, and it was backed up by pictures in the paper that week. They had beautiful rotogravure sections in the Sunday paper. A bunch of people, men, had decided that they would dig up the graveyard of a monastery and of a nunnery. They were sure that there would be a whole lot of babies interred there with their mothers who had died in childbirth. Of course, they didn't find any at all, but the paper had photographs of these graveyards just spaded up and the bones lying all over the place.
You know, that interests me very much because that kind of rumor is prevalent in many areas.
Yes.
I went to St. Ambrose College, and one of the rumors at St. Ambrose College was that the priests had a slide that went into the Mississippi River for the babies that were born.
Gosh.
I remember that was we talked to Father Tagenberg Tacky, a wonderful guy, about that, whom we could talk mm-hmm. with. Him. He was so wonderful. And he had one big laugh about that. But it's interesting.
Yes.
Spread around.
When you get an anti-clerical feeling.
Oh, yes. That's well, of course, Spain, the anti-clericalism, as I've read the history of Spain, they've had three major revolutions plus
yes.
others. And in every single one, the church was a target.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the reason for it was the repressive nature of the church in Spain, plus the amount of railroad and land that the Jesuits
yes.
owned. Now, the local priests in Spain became quite different. By the way, here's an interesting thing that just came to my mind. When I went back to visit San Pedro de Cardenas and spent some time with Padre Marcos, who was one of the priests there, and he told me that he had just returned, this was in 78, he had just returned from an all-nation conference of the church. And there had been a motion made at the conference for the Catholic Church to apologize to the Spanish people for its role in the Civil War.
Really?
And a majority voted to apologize.
Mm-hmm.
But you needed two-thirds, mm-hmm. so it didn't pass. Now, it wasn't that I didn't trust Padre Marcos. I met him and spent several days. We were there about close on to 2 weeks, and every day he spent time with us, I liked him. But nonetheless, I looked it up, and sure enough,
mm-hmm.
I have a written report in the newspaper
mm-hmm.
of that conference, and they did make that motion to mm-hmm. apologize. Now, of course, the Spanish priests, the local priests, were very, very, well, not only, there were also some, there was a Bishop Tarragona who were very, very active in the underground. When Franco was in power, mm-hmm. there was an underground, a kind of an alliance of the, what was called the Workers' Commissions and the Catholic Church, not mm-hmm. the hierarchy.
Yeah.
And they were apparently very effective, although no doubt Franco lived his life through. I mean, they didn't overthrow Franco, the change came after Franco. And so that it changed, the Catholic Church, I think, changed a great deal
mm-hmm.
in Spain, became, at least on it in its lower levels, closer to the people
after the land had been nationalized, the clergy was allowed to stay as caretakers.
The land was nationalized?
Mm-hmm. I think that
In certain areas, the anarchists, I think, but the Republic was opposed to land nationalization, weren't they?
I made a few notes on something.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think in the area just below Barcelona where the anarchists were strong, but the Republic itself took a position against the nationalization and in fact sent the army in to take back some of the land. Hmm.
I don't have a note about that. Jesuit order was banned. In 31, in the new constitution with universal suffrage, no member of the clergy or army was eligible to be president, and there was to be complete religious freedom.
Yes,
and education was secularized, no under
church
control,
the church and state.
Jesuit order was dissolved.
Was dissolved?
31.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
January. Uh-huh. January 32, the Jesuit order was dissolved. The little creata, the native all work we had.